Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How are the lives of today's American women different from those of our mothers and grandmothers? While females in many industries still earn less than their male counterparts in the same jobs, we have come a long way from the days when companies avoided promoting women to top positions or openly refused to hire them at all. And consider this, in the first half of the 20th century, women in many states couldn't apply for loans without a man to co-sign and were expected to turn over what they earned and owned to their husbands to control. So how did the dynamic changes of the past half century come about, and what do they portend for our future? Gail Collins is an op-ed columnist and a former editorial page editor for The New York Times. Her new book is called When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. Gail, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
It would seem that the heart of our progress toward a place of social and political equality lies in participation in the economy. And yet this wasn't even something that women expected or even thought they wanted in 1960.
No, it certainly for the average woman was not something. And to be a real success in 1960 was to have a husband who was successful enough that you didn't have to work.
Of course, some women have always worked outside the home throughout our history, particularly those without economic advantages.
Yeah, it's very interesting in American history, if you like sort of track it, that the vision of what women are and supposed to be is really the vision of what middle-class women are and supposed to be. The fact that poor women have always worked is sort of ignored or not considered relevant.
I think you have a great use of this metaphor in the book for the role of women in early American history. We were placed on a pedestal by men who believed it was their duty to care for us, but standing on a pedestal leaves one very little room to move around.
Yeah, you're just trapped right there and you can't get down very easily either. You're just sort of stuck on that pedestal.
What was a good wife supposed to do?
A good wife, it's so important. And one of the really liberating things for me when I wrote this history was, if you look back at what women have done throughout American history, it's not like they were sort of sitting around whining and waiting to be liberated. Whatever the context of a period was, they always stepped up to the plate. They always did, incredible things. For most of our history, this was an agricultural country, and the life of a farm wife, for instance, a successful farm wife, was both very rewarding and completely exhausting. And she certainly contributed economically to the family, and she had a real place of respect. The kind of interesting dynamic happened when people started moving into the cities, trying to figure out exactly what the role of the woman was then.
We have an amazing story in the book of a woman who talks about getting up every morning at 4 so that she could weed in the family garden until 6:30 and then turn around and pull things out of that garden and make breakfast.
Yeah, and she, they would can until 2 o'clock in the morning when canning time came around, and she made her kids clothes. And she was a wonderful woman. She's still alive, of course, in Wyoming, and she really lived out her early life just as a colonial woman would have done. They had no electricity, at one point when things got really good, they had this machine-operated, gas-driven washer that she could use that, to me, as she was describing it, sounded more exhausting than, plowing the field, trying to make the thing work. And her daughters, too, who don't live on farms, remembered that as like a really great and wonderful time.
You know, it's funny, Gail. I mean, I complain today about laundry, and I have a fancy machine that washes it and one that dries it for me. And laundry was no small task for women in the early part of the 20th century.
Oh, my Lord. Well, of course, earlier on, women solved that problem by not doing it. The cleanliness thing really did not kick in until about 100 years ago. But I talked to some women when I was doing the book who had been housewives in the 1960s, and I think it was the first time in their lives anybody asked them to really discuss how they did the laundry and what they did. But, oh, my Lord, to iron a shirt involved first you got the shirt sort of dry on the line, and then you sprinkled it, and then you got some starch packets and made some starch mixture, and you dipped the collar in the starch, and then you ironed it, and then meanwhile you've got your other shirts in the refrigerator wrapped up so that they don't get too dry in the process. And the woman I talked to most about it said she could really never break the 12-minute mark when it came to doing a shirt.
So it would take her 12 minutes to actually iron it so that it was
to iron one shirt. And, you know, back then you also had, usually if you were a young housewife, women married at the age of 20, the median age was, and they really quickly had several children. So you probably had several kids running around the house, too. You were really, really, really busy.
You know, I think this book is interesting because we tend to think of Rosie the Riveter as what changed the way we thought about Americans' participation, women's participation in the workforce. But in fact, after the Second World War ended, everybody expected Rosie to go back home.
Yeah, that was actually true for World War One too. There's always in America been an expectation that if there's an emergency, women are going to do whatever is expected of them, and wars are always big emergencies. Or actually, whenever the economy needs women to do something, we figure out some way to think of this as an appropriate thing to do. It's kind of our national genius.
There was a point, though, when finally we decided that it was sort of wholesome for a young woman to work for a few years until she found herself a husband.
Yeah, that was a great example of how the economy works its way around what it is that you're going to do anyway. When we first invented the public school system, it was clear that there were not nearly enough guys and that we were not going to pay enough to get the guys to come anyway to teach. And suddenly a country that always had believed that proper middle-class women did not work outside the home decided that teaching didn't really count, that was kind of a maternal thing, so it was okay if you did that. And then when businesses, when big paper-using businesses came into being, suddenly it was okay for a few years for a girl to prepare for marriage by being a secretary, which was unusual.
And
that's exactly what happened when we talk about how everything changed. It changed in large part because after World War II, there were way too many jobs being created for men to fill, and you really did need that woman's participation.
And the idea back then was if you couldn't find a decent man, then you'd have to go to the next rung and take a woman on.
Yeah, and Lyndon Johnson had a very inspiring thing about urging businesses to consider women if they, run through the disabled and teenagers and immigrants and everybody else he could think of in the entire world, then you should go and consider a woman.
I like the stuff that you had in there about the airline industry. My grandmother was a stewardess in the 30s and loved it. And
was she really?
Was devastated when she married my grandfather, loved him, but he got to stay on as a pilot, and she suddenly had nothing to do all day.
Yeah, that was in 1960. There's so many metaphors for not moving around. And the clothes women wore, the way people looked at sports back then, if you traveled, if you wanted to travel, if that was your goal, the only kind of job you could get as a woman in 1960 was as a stewardess, and it was regarded as incredibly glamorous. There were 100 applicants for every job opening, and there were schools that were set up just to teach people how to apply for the openings in the schools. I mean, it just went on and on and on, but it was a huge, 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 huge deal to become a stewardess. You could get your name in the paper if you became a stewardess.
But then you also had to be very attractive.
You had to be very attractive, and you had to be single. And if you got married, as it happened to your grandmother, you were instantly out. So the average tenure of a stewardess was only 18 months. One of the stewardesses I talked to for the book said that she was on a cross-country flight with another woman who was secretly married. And the company found out about it, and when they stopped to refuel in Chicago, an executive from the airline came on the plane and took the woman out, and she was never seen again. It was an absolute rule.
Well, and one thing that's fascinating about this whole setup was that it was in part because that short tenure meant that these women never realized how poorly they were being treated and never sort of got disillusioned and didn't unionize.
Yeah, well, there was a union, which they never got to know anything about because they were only there for 18 months. And it was never discussed by the airline, which kept talking about this only in terms of how their customers, who are almost all men, really needed to have a woman who was attractive and, charming and so on and so forth for their traumatic flight in the airplane. But in fact, the great advantage was these women never had filed for health benefits. They never retired. They were incredibly, incredibly cheap, and they got very low pay as well.
I was struck by how many women who today are ultra-modern and liberated that said that in 1960 they didn't even realize that things weren't equal.
Yeah, but even if they did, they didn't. Women compared themselves to other women. They didn't compare themselves to men. So things that now would cause you to just fall on the floor with shock. Nora Ephron told me that she applied for a job at Newsweek when she got out of college, and they said, women don't write. Women can research, but they don't write. And she just said, oh, okay, and she went on and did something else. Women who worked for the Justice Department in Washington at that time told me that they were told when they were hired, well, you know, you're going to have to work three times as hard as any guy if you expect to maintain your job. And they just said, well, yes, of course I will, and moved on with it. It was just, they were internally, I think, many of them, you know, really kind of seething, but it never really popped to the surface.
Gail Collins is with us. She's an op-ed columnist for The New York Times. Her new book is called When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. Gail will be in town October 29th for a luncheon sponsored by the Dallas Women's Foundation. We will return to our conversation with her in just a couple of minutes. Right now, though, we want to ask you to give us a call at 1-800-456-5372 or go online to kera.org. If you are interested right now in making a $120 contribution or higher to KERA, Betsy Lewis, we can get a copy to you of Gail's new book.
Which is amazing, and we do hope you are enjoying the conversation so far. You know, it's autumn time, and we know that because of two things. It's a rainy day, and the KERA campaign fundraising campaign is underway. So get yourself, pour another cup of coffee, snuggle in, listening to Think, and call 1-800-456-5378. Your call.
5372.
5372. 1-800-456-5372. Or go online to kera.org. Your contribution right now at the amount that is right for you will put us that much closer to getting over the $200,000 mark today.
You know, Betsy, there is this odd phenomenon. We have a lot of people who are loyal listeners who love the station, who never miss the show or never miss Morning Edition or All Things Considered or any of the other programs, and listen to these drives and are with us and pulling for us and waiting for KERA to reach the goal, who never imagine that it's about them. You know, maybe you're one of these people. You listen and you're excited for us and you hope that these other people will call. We're actually talking to you. We're actually asking that you be the person to pick up the phone. It is not some, you know, the vast majority of people who contribute to the station are regular middle-class people just like Betsy and me. People who just decide public radio is important and you can do 20 or 30 bucks a month or 5 bucks a month or 50 bucks a month because this is something that you value.
And because it all happens in baby steps. We throw out these huge numbers like $200,000 today. But that happens by the contributions of each individual. So we are, as Chris said, we are talking to you. And whatever little amount you can contribute, you get to define what little amount actually means.
1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org. It really is sort of a beautiful thing if you think about it. Everybody coming together and giving what amount makes sense to you and works for your budget. Folks like George Guvin in Fort Worth have already done so today. Claudia Sima in Fort Worth, Jennifer Unterberg in Dallas. Thanks to all of you. Also to Denton Holland in Dallas and Sandra Zorowski in Midlothian. Perhaps you are on the line right now. We can't wait to read your name next. So give us a call now at 1-800-456-5372.
You are keeping the drive going strong and you are keeping us ahead of schedule right now. So we may finish up by the end of this month. We may not, but it is up to you to make that happen and to continue the great programming on KERA.
You have the power to make this possible. Again, our number is 1-800-456-5372. You can also go online to kera.org. Consider a $120 contribution, and we'll be able to send you a copy of Gail Collins' new book, When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. Of course, you don't have to take a thank you gift, but if it puts you over the edge, we are delighted to send it to you. Give us a call now, 800-456-5372. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times op-ed columnist Gail Collins. Her new book is called When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372. Gail, talk for a minute about how we women saw ourselves presented in the media in the 60s.
You know, my favorite, the huge thing back then was Westerns on TV, you know, the cowboy shows, Gunsmoke and Half a Gun Will Travel. And the all-time most popular one, I think, was Bonanza.
Sure.
Bonanza was the story. It just makes me crazy. It was the story of a guy who owns this huge ranch in Nevada, I think it was, and he has three sons. He's been widowed three times. Each son has a different mother. They're all dead. And the sons are always constantly, you know, having, God help, nobody think they were gay. So, I mean, they were always having romance, but they always died. If one of the Bonanza boys got engaged, you knew that by the first commercial, this girl was going to be killed. Something terrible would happen. Never go near the Cartwright boys, I would say. But it was the message you got from this and from all the shows in that period was that girls never did anything interesting. If there was going to be an adventure, you were not going to have any women around unless the woman was kidnapped. Inside the comedies, the situation comedies, the women were all sitting in the kitchen with their pearls on, you know, making dinner or stirring a pot. But that's why I always loved Buffy the Vampire Slayer was, I think, my all-time favorite, because suddenly you had this whole reversal of that whole image from the 60s. You know, Buffy walks alone. Buffy cannot have anyone in her life because she's the loner who has to save the world every week. And it's exactly the opposite of the message you got from all of those TV shows. And my other favorite was the Star Trek episode in which a woman takes over Captain Kirk's brain because she's very frustrated because women couldn't be starship captains. This was the first year's episodes. And they instantly knew that there was something wrong with Captain Kirk because he kept filing his nails and getting hysterical fits all the time when he was frustrated. It was not a good time on the media for women, I would say.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about the old Dick Van Dyke Show, which is so interesting because you had Mary Tyler Moore then, and then later she's in this amazing sort of breakout role. The only woman we ever saw working in that show was poor old Rosemary, and she would have ditched it all in a heartbeat.
Oh, was talking all the time about guys. Yes. You know, the important thing about that Dick Van Dyke Show was that Mary Tyler Moore herself wore pants when she was keeping house. And this was the first time on TV that they showed a woman wearing pants. And it was hugely controversial. And they took them off her, and then people said, no, 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 and then they put them back on. The whole pants thing to me was just sort of a great metaphor for that period, the idea that, you know, you couldn't wear pants because you were on the pedestal. And also that you didn't move around much, because if you didn't wear pants, then back in the day, there were no pantyhose, so you had to wear nylon stockings, you had to wear a girdle, you had all this stuff. I mean, you were really constrained in a big way.
Yeah, even that phrase, so-and-so wears the pants in the family.
Yeah, that was sort of part of the scariness of the idea, I guess, of women wearing pants, and that it was so comfortable. You could move around, you could do stuff, you could maybe play sports, which very few women did back in 1960.
So you had Betty Friedan sort of tapping into this heretofore silent undercurrent of dissatisfaction among American women, particularly those who were married and at home. How did her book start to change the way people thought about their lives?
You know, it's very interesting that the people that she was writing to, one of the many, 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 many effects of the post-war economic boom was that families could send their daughters to school, to college, in a much larger number than they had before. Before then, you know, that women had gone to college if they were really determined to have a career and perhaps not marry or not have children, or if they were rather wealthy. But suddenly you had all of these middle-class young women going to college, taking the same courses as the guys, doing as well as the guys, working on the same track as the guys, and then suddenly they all get married, because it was, you were really considered a failure if you didn't get engaged by your senior year. That was just sort of the way it was back then. And although most women who went off to live in the suburbs and raise families and be full-time housewives, I think had a wonderful time because things were so much better for them and their families than they had been before the war, there was a really good chunk of these women, particularly college-educated women, and that's who she was talking to, who just got there and were stunned to discover that they were bored out of their minds and they were frustrated and they were unhappy and they didn't know why, because the whole goal of their lives had been to get married to a guy who was a good earner, who was a good husband, and they'd done that and had the children. And they were, one woman said she would, you know, hang up her clothes on the line and her tears were streaming down her cheeks every day, and she didn't know why. She couldn't figure it out. And so suddenly here comes Betty Friedan saying, of course you're miserable. Why? Of course this is all a plot, and stop. And her message was actually, if you read it now, very conservative. All she wanted was to let these women go and have a job. I mean, she wasn't talking about even, you know, household chores. She was just saying, why can't we have jobs? You know, we should, that's our, the answer to all this is we should be allowed to go out and get jobs.
I'm glad you brought up the issue of household chores, because this remains, even in today's pretty egalitarian marriages among younger people, a huge issue. Women still feel like they're doing more. And according to the statistics, they are, in fact, doing more around the house, even with the same number of hours worked outside the home as their husbands.
Yeah, you know, I would say that right now, guys, compared to the last a generation before, are way more involved in child rearing. Although I don't think statistics suggest that they do 50% of it. You do. I mean, I certainly do all the time see guys, you know, really, 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 really invested in their kids. Household chores, on the other hand, is rarely a tough hoe. We had a woman at the Times who did a story about families who actually do divide all the chores 50-50, and it's a huge effort. There are charts and there are lists. And it's partly, I think, because guys just have a different bar when it comes to, you know, the level of achievement and domesticity that should be required. And it's very hard for women to see, you know, the house sort of looking awful and the kids going off to school wearing, you know, polka dots and stripes. And, you know, because, you know, they just, and no one really knows deep in their hearts whether it's the guys are just waging a war of resistance or that they truly, you know, don't see the stripes and the polka dots. But they're definitely in the household chore thing is a problem. And also women tend to be the last responsible person. While guys do a lot with their children, it's the woman who, you know, has to figure out whose birthday party it is and who has to be where when and keeps track of all the stuff and who probably gets called if the child is sick.
In defense of the guys out there who are trying to adjust to this new reality, do you think part of it is that women also, you know, in the same way that maybe men in the 70s didn't want to move aside and let a woman work next to them, women don't want to give up the idea that they are still the queen of the household?
It could be, but I do think that the larger issue is that women do have higher standards, that they don't, you know, they're willing to, they want their husbands to step up and do half, but they want them to step up and do half their way,
yeah.
You know, which is kind of a problem. And this whole story, you know, I'm always conscious that we have this, I sit around all the time talking with people about this incredible, amazing, you know, fantastic to me story about what happened to women over the past 50 years. And it's just, to me, with all the caveats about things that are undone, just the most thrilling thing, that thoughts about the limitations of women and the role of women in society that have existed for a millennium just crashed down in my lifetime. It just knocks me out. But it is also a story about guys and how they changed. And Nora Ephron said to me in the book, you know, you feel so sorry for the guys who got married in the old rules in 1960, and then they just come home one day, and it's like, what did I do? I don't know. What's happening here? And suddenly their wives are having meetings, consciousness-raising groups in the living room discussing how their husbands are failing to give them the proper orgasms. And it just was this huge, huge leap overnight. And when you think about the amount that guys had to digest, I think many of them did rather well about it all.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Gail Collins is my guest. We're talking today about her new book, When Everything Changed. Let's go on the line to Craig in Dallas. Hey, Craig.
Hello, Chris. You know, back in the late 40s, early 50s, after Truman's executive order, the desegregation of the military came to be, and I think it probably played a pretty significant role in shaping that issue in broader society. I'm wondering, I think women's opportunities in the military didn't come to be much of anything until the period of time that your book covers. I'm wondering if you looked at the role the military has played in the status of women today.
Thanks for
coming. Yeah, I did quite a bit in the book, and it really is fascinating because, you know, although women were in theory allowed in the military, all the rules about combat, that women could not engage in combat, covered such an enormous multitude of jobs that there were really very few opportunities for advancement. And there was, if anybody remembers the ERA fights back in the 70s, there was a real resistance on the part of the public to any idea that women might be in combat or be put in danger. And then, again, and everything sort of changed, and it started to change after the war in Vietnam, which was a time that the military, you know, the draft was gone, and the military was sort of in disarray, and it was hard to get really good recruits, and they found that the caliber of women that they could get was, in fact, really higher than often the caliber of men they could get. And it was at that point that you started to have a lot of women moving into the military. And then once we moved into the wars in the Middle East, when it's impossible to say what a combat situation is, you suddenly had women who were dying for their country in numbers, who were being taken prisoner of war. And interestingly, you don't hear public outcry about this. You don't hear the public saying, oh, my God, we never thought that there would be women being killed. Boom. We have, I think, the honor roll of women who have been killed in the Iraq-Afghanistan conflict is maybe pressing 200. And just all sorts of dramatic stories. And the country has just adjusted to it in a really fascinating way.
Gail Collins is with us. She's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. Her new book is called When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. Gail will be in Dallas October 29th for a luncheon sponsored by the Dallas Women's Foundation. We will resume our conversation with her in a moment, and you're welcome to join us at 1-800-933-5372. We would ask first that you join KERA as a member, either by renewing your existing membership or perhaps starting a brand new one. That telephone number is 1-800-456-5372. And Betsy Lewis is here with us now. Hey, Betsy.
Good afternoon, Chris, and good afternoon to you. And don't forget that no matter what amount you choose to contribute at today, the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas, which is another local not-for-profit here in North Texas, will add an additional $25 to your contribution. So if you choose to contribute at $100, you're actually contributing at $125, getting us that much closer to the finish line.
Wonderful news. And that's every contribution over $100, the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas is adding
right.
$25. That's really cool. It just it's one way to make your money go a little bit further. And in this economy, that's what we're all looking for all the time. 1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. You can also go to kera.org online. As we often do, as a thank you gift today, we are able to offer you a copy of this guest book, Gail Collins' new book, When Everything Changed. It is really an interesting history of recent America, and it's written in a way that doesn't simply look at the political leaders and the huge sweeping changes. It also has a lot of stories of real-life regular women and their experiences, and there's a lot in here that I think, whether you're a man or a woman, you can probably relate to the people in your life. So it's a great read. If you'd like to have a copy and support KERA, make a $120 contribution now at 1-800-456-5372.
We have already heard this afternoon from Weldon Lee in Lindale. Thank you, Weldon. Thomas Odonsky in Richardson. And Tracy Owens in Grand Prairie. So thanks. We're hearing from the suburbs. That's wonderful.
Excellent.
To know. It's a great time to contribute at $150 or $365 or $500, whatever's right for you. We would love to say thank you to you live on air, and you can hear KERA's own Chris Boyd, say your name during Think if you call and contribute.
I'm not sure
right
that's
now.
Much of an incentive, but I'm happy to do it. 1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org. You know, we know that not everybody likes to take a thank you gift. And in fact, if you don't, then we take your entire contribution, and instead of using part of it to buy a book that we send to you, we will put it all to work for programming. But look, I have no snobbery when it comes to thank you gifts. If this is something that is a nice little extra for you and it makes you decide that you want to make the contribution, by all means, that is exactly why they're there. And we would love to be able to say thanks that way.
So here is another nice perk if you contribute today. Our friends at the new Omni Hotel in Fort Worth have offered a special incentive to everyone that makes a donation today. And that doesn't mean that if you've already become a member during this drive, that you can't call and make an additional gift to be included in this. During Marketplace today, we will have a drawing for a one-night stay and breakfast for two at the new Omni Hotel in downtown Fort Worth. So you want to be sure and get in on that. So just think, if you call and contribute at the $125 level, you will be entered into this drawing, and you could be sitting cuddled up at the new Omni Hotel in Fort Worth with a copy of Gail Collins' book, When Everything Changed. And best of all, you will be part of the KERA community as well.
Wonderful. You already know what your money is paying for because you're listening to it right now. We exist because of member contributions, people just like you, just like me and Betsy, who love the station, who feel it's an important part of a vibrant community, who want to make sure that there is locally produced programming. These are the people, just like you, who pick up the phone and make a contribution. 1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. You can also go to kera.org. I think the average gift to radio is something a little over $120 a year. That may be far less than you feel is appropriate for you based on your love of KERA and your financial situation. It may be more than you can do. That decision is entirely up to you, and we leave it to you. Just, we do ask that you make a call and make some kind of contribution.
And our gratitude is the exact same no matter what amount. Like we've been saying, every little bit gets us there. And this is your station, so the number to call is 1-800-456-5372 or go to kera.org online.
If you want to check out thank you gifts, you can always do that online at kera.org. You can set up your membership there as well. You might be interested in what we call the sustaining membership, which basically divides your annual contribution out so that it goes every month, and that sort of lasts until you tell us to change it. But it is easy to change it if you want to increase the amount. In fact, maybe you've been a $10 a month member and you're ready to do 15. We would love to hear from you, and our volunteers can take that pledge. 1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. We will be back in just a minute with Gail Collins. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Op-ed columnist Gail Collins of the New York Times is with us today. Her new book is called When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. Gail will be in town October 29th for a Dallas Women's Foundation luncheon. If you would like to join our conversation, give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Gail, you have a lot in the book about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who I think is a fascinating case study in that today she is one of the most powerful women in the world, and yet for the better part of 30 years really sublimated her own ambitions and abilities to her husband's career.
Yeah, one of the many fascinating things about Hillary Clinton is that she really mirrored her generation in so many ways, considering that she's the most unique woman probably in the world. It's kind of amazing how familiar her path is. She was the smartest girl in her class, and then she was the smartest girl in her college, and she went to law school, and she lived with her boyfriend, and she got married, and then she had those work family tensions, and they didn't exercise themselves as they do for most women in childcare issues. She had to move to Arkansas, where her husband's political career was, and Arkansas is not really a great place to go if you're planning a really serious career in public law. And so she really did take the back seat. Although I know she thought of herself as a partner, it really was, the decision was that his career was going to come first.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Mandy in Arlington. Hi, Mandy.
Hi. I actually just had a quick comment. I'm a little bit younger, so I wasn't around for what was going on in the 60s and 70s. But, coming from the construction industry, I can see, still some of the way that people think about women in the workplace, with it being a little bit more conservative. And I don't know if I'm the only one that noticed this, but, men could, raise their voices and, get a little bit angry about things. But if I ever did that, wow, it was not a good reaction from people. I was expected to be, very calm and very quiet in all of my responses. So I just wondered if anybody else sees that.
Yeah, thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Gail?
Construction is one of the hardest nuts to crack, really, when it comes to women's participation in the workplace. And I talked to women who had broken into various unions earlier on in the 60s and 70s, and it was just really murder. And they never really did take a foothold as they did in so many other industries. And whenever you've got some new area where people aren't used to having a lot of women around, you really do have all these kind of rules about how you have to behave and how you've got to meet certain expectations, and it's very tough. And she's right. The story continues. As amazing as I think the change is right now, if you happen to be in construction, it doesn't look quite as amazing, I think.
Talk for a minute about how things changed with Title IX.
Title IX was so interesting. The law was a law that was intended to equalize educational opportunities, and basically said if you're a school that takes federal money, you have to give equality of opportunity to women and men. And I don't think they thought that the main point of the thing was going to be to get more girls athletics, but that tended to be the thing people focused on because it became so dramatic, the opportunities that girls suddenly got and how hungry they were for them. And they came forward at that point with all of these pathetic stories. I remember actually one of them was a Texas story. I think it was Waco. Waco in 1960 had, I think, $1 million in equipment and facilities for high school athletics, of which girls were allowed to use the tennis balls. That was about it. And there was one in Cedar Rapids about, the boys on the tennis team played on the courts and the girls' tennis team played in the driveway. And it just sort of went on and on and on like that. And, of course, poor Billie Jean King, when she was starting out, was already, I think, a Wimbledon champion when she went to college in doubles and did not get a scholarship. She had to work in the parks department to put her way through, and her husband-to-be, who assured her he was a much worse tennis player than she was, had a full scholarship. You just didn't do that stuff for women back then. And when it changed, it was really huge. Sarah Palin, who is not, I think, somebody who people normally think of in the forefront of the feminist movement, but talks all the time about Title IX and how she got to play basketball in high school and how important that was for her. And it's been so huge. Who would have thought that would be one of the really big deals? But it was.
You also write about the fact that, realistically, the women's movement made Phyllis Schlafly possible.
Yeah, it was so funny. That was what drove women. Phyllis Schlafly was, of course, the woman who fought the Equal Rights Amendment. And I think, really, it was one of the few cases in which you had something really huge happening that you could really say, this is the person who did it. If it wasn't for Phyllis Schlafly, I suspect the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, would have passed. But she drove the women's movement crazy because they were arguing against a woman who was doing all the things that they felt they had made possible. She had a big family, lots of small children. She was breastfeeding while she was running around out, on the road making all these speeches. She said there was always somebody you could hand a baby off to when you went up on stage. And she wrote several books, about the evils of liberals and the communist conspiracy and the glories of Barry Goldwater and so on. And she ran around all over the place, and she was going to law school at the same time. She was just an extraordinary woman, and some of the women who ran into her at the time claimed that when they would sit in the green room of various TV stations waiting to go out and yell at each other, she would admit that if it hadn't been for the women's movement, she wouldn't have gotten to do all this stuff, but she certainly never admitted it publicly.
Do you think that today's young women really get it?
You know, it hurts the feelings of older women that younger women, you know, don't sort of have this real consciousness often of all the stuff that went before. To me, the fact that you do have young women who just grow up and come into the world with absolutely no thought that their genders are going to hold them back from doing anything is so fantastic. I mean, that's just the best thing in the world. I mean, I think if you've got the history, then it's even neater. And I just love it when I can sort of share it with younger women. But that part of the problems that still exist, and the, you know, your previous caller was talking about, there are lots of women who realize that there's still a lot of fights out there to be fought. You know, I talk to young women, and many of them think that whatever job they're at, once they get to a certain point in it, that they do find that you have to really struggle harder if you're a woman. And as they come up against those things, I think that the younger generation is just incredibly determined, but sometimes it does come as a surprise to them. And it bothers people that most young women, I would bet, don't like the idea of being called a feminist. There's something about that word that drives people crazy, and that's been historically true. Even back in the 20s, people were writing essays about how they thought feminists must be people with bad shoes. You know, there's just something, you know, about they're not cool, they're not pretty, they're not, you know, glamorous. They're just, you know, yelling at you all the time. I always wondered if we could find some other word for it, just call it Fred or something, and maybe people would feel better about it.
Gail, what kinds of values and compromises do you see reflected in the choices of a first lady like Michelle Obama?
Well, you know, during the campaign, I thought this last campaign was finally going to be the time that we were really going to talk about the question of the tensions between family and work and how you suddenly have half the workforce is female and nobody has talked about who's going to take care of the kids. And I thought this would be the time because you had two candidates in Sarah Palin and Barack Obama who had young children and who had working spouses. And this just seemed perfect. But it really didn't happen. But I've got to give it to Michelle Obama. She was out there having one roundtable or conference or panel or after another about this issue. And she's very upfront about the fact that she does not think that under current circumstances it's really possible for most women to have it all. That you know, it's very, 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 very hard to try to both have a really aggressive career and to be a really active parent raising small children. And I think, you know, that's kind of reflected in, of course, she's in an unusual position, not only as First Lady, but before that, if you're not only, it's like being a single parent, really, being the wife of a politician who's running for a big office. You just do not get any support at all because they're never home. But as it her vision of it is a very, you know, challenged one. I mean, I think she thinks that there are very big, you know, issues there to be dealt with.
She was lucky, I suppose, that her mom was able to move in and help out.
Yeah, and that's been the story all along, boy. You know, you want to have a mother there. Look at Sarah Palin. There's like 10,000 Palins running around who are supporting that family and you know, taking care of the kids and being there when there's problems up there.
Gail Collins is an op-ed columnist and former editorial page editor for The New York Times. Her new book is called When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. She will be in town October 29th for a luncheon hosted by the Dallas Women's Foundation. Learn more about that at dallaswomensfoundation.org. Gail, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. I want to thank all of you who are listening this hour, all of you who perhaps have called to receive a copy of Gail's new book, When Everything Changed. We have that available today as a thank you gift with a $120 contribution or more. Don't limit yourself to $120 if you were going to give $250, but you still want this as your thank you gift. We are, by all means, able to send that to you. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the station, is 1-800-456-5372. You can also go to kera.org. Remember that today. Any contribution that you choose to make that is $100 or more, your contribution will be supplemented with an additional $25 contribution to KERA by the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas. Fine group of folks who believe in the importance of having strong public radio in the community have put up $5,000 for this challenge. So every $100 gift made today will be increased by $25 thanks to the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas. Betsy Lewis is with us now. Hello, Betsy.
Hello, Chris. Good afternoon. And for another added incentive, the people at the new Omni Hotel in Fort Worth will be offering a one-night stay and breakfast for two at their beautiful new residence. Would you call a hotel a residence?
An inn, perhaps? A very
at their beautiful
glamorous,
new inn.
Glamorous and gigantic inn.
And that drawing will take place today during Marketplace. So if you contribute by 6:30 today, you will be included. Your name will be included somewhere in that magic drawing. And if you've already become a member, you can still be included in that drawing if you'd like to make an additional gift today.
I like the fast gratification we have on this, too. So you'll know by the end of the day if you have won this wonderful prize, which is kind of nice.
Absolutely. It's not that far away. It's really just a few hours. So Omni Hotel.
1-800-456-5372 to make that contribution. You can also go online, rather, to kera.org. Public radio in some ways is also about instant gratification. Of course, we work long and hard for something that seems as if it happens instantly, but the point is that it's here all the time for you. It is always available. It is always available because of listener contributions. People like you who say, yeah, it matters to me that I have public radio. Yeah, I would miss it if it weren't here, and there would be so many things that I don't have a chance to sort of mull over and explore thanks to this wonderful medium. Your contribution makes it possible.
And you know that Think is produced right here at KERA, although I am the person that answers the calls whenever people respond and want to contribute a
And thank comment you for that, by the way.
Or a question. And occasionally, when I ask them what city they're from, they will tell me Coppell, Texas, and add it right on. And I'm always fascinated that the programming is so consistent between if you listen to Diane Rehm and then go into Fresh Air and then right into Think, no matter if the KERA dollars are going to purchasing the national programming from NPR or if it's producing our homegrown Think and anything you ever wanted to know, it's your dollars that make those things happen. So call 1-800-456-5372 or go online at kera.org, and that is safe and secure, and you won't have to worry for the rest of the pledge drive about doing your part for KERA.
And that feels nice. You will be supporting your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, and online at kera.org. We come to you now just three times a year. We have winnowed it down because everyone has said, oh, the fundraising drives are just making me crazy. Well, the truth is, this is how honestly, we don't know a better way. If somehow we were able to raise funds from you without ever interrupting programming, believe me, by now we would have switched to that. But this is the way it happens. We come to you, we tell you how much we need to earn. In this case, it's $600,000 in listener contributions. Once we reach that goal in this fundraising campaign, we will quit until the next one, which is months and months away. So make your contribution now. Get us to that place where we can get back to a full schedule of regular programming. The telephone number is 1-800-456-5372.
So what is your reason for donating? You know best. I could sit here and list all of the programming on KERA, but you know your very favorite part of being part of the KERA community in North Texas. So take a few minutes and think about your favorite show. It may be on the weekend. It may be a daily thing. It may be something you just catch accidentally. The first time I heard Radiolab on the weekend, I didn't know it was going to be there. And I fell madly, madly in love with that programming. So what experience have you had that way? Have you ever had have you ever been in a situation where you had the radio on? It didn't matter what program it was, but you just couldn't get out of your car until that story was over.
A driveway moment.
A driveway moment. Chris even has a name for it. The driveway moment. It's a phenomenon.
And you have probably experienced that. If you know, we always say this, if you are still with us listening through the membership drive, you are hooked on public radio. There's no two ways about it. We appreciate that. And we ask that you realize that when we have these fundraising drives, we are indeed talking to you. Whatever you happen to be doing right now, if you're hearing us, we're speaking to you and asking you to give us a little bit of money. 1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number, or a lot of money if that's possible for you. You can also go online and make a contribution at kera.org.
So for a little progress check right now, we are at $180,000. We're trying to make it, if possible, to $200,000 by the end of today. So let's keep that momentum up and focus North Texas and become a part of the KERA community today.
You can do it by calling 1-800-456-5372. Make a $120 contribution, and you can choose to receive Gail Collins' new book, When Everything Changed. You can also go online and make a contribution at kera.org. Thank you.
The Think Team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.